But I really decided for sure that I wasn't going to buy a house where the mortgage was going to cost me more than renting. That was just something that I went into it with. I just decided if I'm going to do this, it needs to make sense financially today and not going to count on market appreciation, et cetera. And so the way that I accomplished that was I actually bought a house that had 5 bedrooms in it. And I didn't know the term house hacking at the time, but I just rented those rooms to friends. And I had a cash flowing asset from day one. And that was how I started that journey. It eventually developed into an Airbnb adventure, but that's kind of how it started.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Suja Shyam is an accomplished professional multifamily underwriter. She's passionate to bring the real estate wealth building model to hardworking, busy people. She's also the founder of Lux Capital, which helps people invest in high-quality, recession-resistant, pre-vetted commercial real estate opportunities. She's passionate about closing the gap and about helping people decouple their time from their income. She's also an Airbnb entrepreneur, which is how she got started in real estate and how she initially found her way into financial independence. Suja, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
The pleasure's mine. The same 3 questions I ask everybody who comes on this show. Can you very quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started out as a graduate student. And I, at the time, had only worked in sort of lower paying jobs. Like I was a social worker. And then I was doing a fellowship, and this was after going to undergrad at Northwestern. And so I wasn't really making much money. And then I went to graduate school. I had known that I didn't want finances to be a limiting factor in my life. And I had pursued this like social worker path, and I was in business school, and I decided, okay, I need to figure out what my first move is going to be. And so anyways, long story short, I used my student loans to make my first real estate investment. And I had no money. I only had loans, really. And so that was how I got into my first deal. And then fast forward, so we flipped that house. I held it for 5 years. And then I also then house hacked on steroids. So that was another huge part of like actually shoring up my financial independence game. And then I became an Airbnb host. And in the middle of that, I took an 18-month trip around the world and realized that I just didn't want to be in corporate America and needed to find a path that where I could control my own time and schedule and be in control of my own destiny, et cetera. And then that all led to me wanting to level up in real estate and help people really learn about how to invest intelligently, how to decouple their time from their income. And I opened this private equity firm that connects people to real estate syndications and teach people about how to do that and how to achieve financial independence.
That's a lot all at once. I'm excited here to jump in. Let's rewind the tape a little bit and go to the house hack on steroids. Can you define that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I bought my first house, I had just gotten a new job and I qualified for a very expensive house. But my dad was a real estate investor growing up, although he didn't like necessarily go big with it, but he did have 3 single-family home rentals, which when he bought them back in the late 80s, early 90s, they were actually negative cash flowing. And they were in San Jose, California. So they're doing great now. And there was obviously a ton of appreciation that happened in that market. But when he bought them, they were negative cash flowing. And so when my sister and I were kids, 4 to 7 or 8 or 9, they were still lean years. And that was one of the reasons. And so what he always told me is that a house is a liability before it's an asset. And so that is not the typical mindset that most people think when they're thinking about buying their first home to live in, their first primary residence. But I really decided for sure that I wasn't going to buy a house that was where the mortgage was going to cost me more than renting. That was just something that I went into it with. I just decided if I'm going to do this, it needs to make sense financially today and not going to count on market appreciation, et cetera. And so the way that I accomplished that was I actually bought a house that had 5 bedrooms in it. And I didn't know the term house hacking at the time, but I just rented those rooms to friends. And I had a cash flowing asset from day one. I bought the cheapest house in the nice neighborhood and was able to find something that was like not flying off the shelf. You know, there wasn't like a bidding war or anything because it's kind of like an odd house, but it worked really well for what I was doing. And that was how I started that journey. It eventually developed into an Airbnb adventure where I didn't have to share the whole house with everyone. We can go into that. But that's kind of how it started.
That's really interesting. Yeah, 5-bedroom, that leaves you 4 rooms you can rent out to your friends. That's brilliant. I love that. Yeah, the Airbnb venture. I mean, how do I say this? Like, Airbnb's on fire. Why did you not just stick with Airbnb and then venture, grow your open up your PE firm?
Yeah, totally. So what Sam's alluding to, so basically I took my single family house and then I turned it into a B&B basically, where I separated out different parts and had 3 Airbnbs at my single family house. And then I purchased a fourplex and transitioned it to a hotel use so that I could legally do Airbnb with it, even with a changing regulatory environment. And the reason that I got into private equity was because it was 2018 when I bought my fourplex, which I transitioned to a hotel. And at that time, people were talking about, it's been a bull market for the last 6 or 7 years. There's going to be a correction sometime. We don't know when. And I just definitely knew that I didn't want to be caught with my pants down. And I knew that Airbnb was not a recession resilient asset class. I mean, it was probably going to be more resilient than hotels in a downturn, but it's still hospitality. It's still travel. It's still leisure. Yes, there's lots of ways that you can protect because, you know, you can have travel nurses and military families, et cetera. There's just all these different people that need Airbnbs, even when it's not a down. But I mean, I will tell you that, you know, now that games are back and now that people are coming to conferences again, that demand is starting to tick back up because I'm in an urban environment. So that does change it. So anyway, so I wanted to, basically I got into private equity because I'm like, I need to diversify outside of hospitality. Almost all of my income was coming from Airbnb, which was hospitality. And I didn't want to be fully in hospitality.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Walk us through the transition to PE and really what you guys are investing in, how you've structured it. I mean, give us just a breakdown on what it is you're doing today.
So first of all, when I was an underwriter professionally, I was working in syndications. And so I actually had a background underwriting large multifamily transactions from $2 to $60 million and had underwritten those or analyzed them and prepared them for institutions to be ready to invest in them. And so I actually had quite a bit of experience. And so when I jumped into the private placement world, which is a different world than the institutional world entirely, it feels kind of more like the Wild Wild West. But at the same time, it's a place where individuals can actually invest rather than just huge banks, pension funds, life insurance companies, et cetera. And so it was really exciting to me that I could apply this business model that I learned from the institutional side just to me as an individual. I'm like, well, all these insurance companies are here making money on affordable housing. Why can't individuals do that? And so the private placement world allows individuals like you and me, regular everyday people who are hardworking and have started saving and have assets that they can access to invest. So I was very excited about this. It took me a while to figure out because, you know, you start listening to Bigger Pockets and this and that, and people are house hacking or flipping or wholesaling and buying duplexes. And actually, I knew that I wanted to operate at a higher level. It just felt like I was kind of past that. And I didn't want to just start wholesaling or flipping. Like, it just, even though it was also not that easy to flip back in the day because the margins were just really thin, the market was so hot. So yeah, so I took like a couple of years to really figure out where it was that I wanted to land in this space, the private placement space. And that meant listening to podcasts, just figuring out whose investment philosophy I could align with. And so I ended up finding people who, mentors who were very focused on recession resilience and downside protection and not necessarily getting caught up in the hype of multifamily. And so that's kind of what I feel like my niche is. So yeah.
Not getting caught up in the hype of multifamily, does that mean you're not a multifamily investor?
Okay, so I should clarify. No, I definitely will invest in real estate. I mean, in multifamily. I consider multifamily to be a recession resilient asset class. However, within the multifamily community, there's obviously pricing is like very high and it's very competitive and you have to be careful about what you buy. And I think that's not only true in multifamily, that's true in any asset class. You have to be careful what you buy. But multifamily, the pricing just keeps going up even more so than other spaces. You have to have a balanced approach to when you're looking at deals. Like, you have to make sure that it's conservatively underwritten and that you're going to be able to deliver on the business plan. But you also have to make sure that it's aggressive enough that you can win deals. And so balancing those two is definitely, in my opinion, it's an art. And at the same time, you have to put a package in front of investors that they're going to be attracted to and excited by. And you also have to educate investors and train them to think like long term or not just think about quick turnaround. Although I know that's what's like having a 2-year time frame is definitely attractive to some people who are at different phases in life, like if they're older or et cetera.
Let's rewind a little bit and talk more about the underwriting side of things. How much time do you spend underwriting today or vetting other people's underwriting?
Yeah, it's a big part of what I do. I take a close look at least one deal a week. And by close look, I mean like really going through the underwriting file and going back and forth with sponsors and making sure that I'm understanding the nuts and bolts of how they're underwriting. And to be honest, like I'm not going to fully underwrite every single deal because that's a pretty big task and it just can't do that every single week right now. But I do look at least one deal and I would say like a medium level.
Gotcha. What are some of the things you look for when I'm assuming you get the underwriting file from the sponsor?
Yeah, for sure. Well, for people who aren't necessarily familiar with underwriting models, there's a few key assumptions that you need to look at and make sure that you're understanding. And the thing is, you got to get a holistic picture because in terms of underwriting standards, it can vary across markets and depending on certain times. And so you have to be able to look at a holistic picture, which takes a little bit of time to kind of figure out how to do. But some of the things you want to look at, for example, are number one, the reversion cap rate. So what cap rate are you buying it at? And within that, understanding what is actually going into the cap rate is extremely important because even the cap rate number can be manipulated depending on what you do and don't include. And so that's like a whole conversation we could go into, but I'll just leave it at that for now. But yeah, so making sure you understand what goes into the cap rate. So then what the going in cap rate is and what the reversion cap rate is and making sure that you understand both those numbers very thoroughly. I would also look at rent growth. I mean, that's a key assumption to look at. And oftentimes people will have different ways of doing that. I would say that if you're going to try to be aggressive in the underwriting, it makes more sense to do that earlier rather than later. So even if you're making a slightly aggressive prediction for a stabilized rent, that's probably more justifiable than justifying, like, for example, 4% rent growth, like every single year, going out 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years into the future. So it'd be more justifiable to say like, well, I think I could get a 10% rent bump within 10 or 12 months based on the fact that rent growth has been like 26% or whatever it's been. So, I mean, 10% is probably a lot for year one. But in any case, a shorter term prediction is one way that you can potentially justify a slightly more aggressive assumption. So rent growth, you got to be very careful about that. Everyone has to understand the market. Like, how well do you understand exactly what types of units are going for what? And that's something that you got to have a property manager who really knows their stuff. So yeah. And then of course, the expense ratio, that's a very important one. And expenses, on one hand, they just are what they are. And yes, you can try to economize on them over time. However, I would say that the expenses are going to be a minor, you know, you can incrementally drop them up until a point. But I feel like people always want to underestimate operating expenses, but there's all these fees that if you're not aware of, for example, like a lease renewal fee, for example, like, I mean, that's just a tiny fee, but that happens only once a year, but it happens once a year on every single unit. Or if that unit has a turnover, then it's like potentially 50% of that lease. And so you got to be aware of all the sort of little expenses that add up. I mean, turnover, what is that actually going to cost? And people don't necessarily budget these like once in a while kinds of expenses into their operating expenses. So those are just a few key things that I would look for.
What are some once in a while expenses you feel like commonly get missed?
Well, like I said, the turnover fee. So when you actually have to turn over a unit, then oftentimes there's paint or repairs or things that just need to be done to get the unit ready to rent at a higher rent level. And that can be pretty substantial. It can be $700 or $800. Another one is lease renewal fee and the lease up fee, right? And so if you're having to pay a couple hundred dollars on every lease that's just a new lease, then that cuts into, you know, even if you raise the rent $50 a month, but you have to pay a $200 lease up fee, then, you know, that's 4 months of the next year where you're just basically paying for that increased lease. And so those are two that come to mind. And then I would say also just making sure that you're budgeting enough for property taxes. I mean, that's a key one you hear a lot about, but that's because it's really important. You got to know exactly what your property taxes are and how they're going to increase. And so you have to be in conversation with the various bodies that are in charge of that and make sure you know it's not just the property taxes that the seller is putting in front of you, but like what you're going to be using for property taxes. And that's sort of, I mean, I think most people kind of know that right now, but it's something that you want to make sure that they're doing.
Right. And just to fully clarify what you were talking about earlier on the lease renewal fee, you were suggesting that that would be something maybe that a property manager would be charging you as the landlord or you as the sponsorship group. Hey, we renewed a lease on apartment, whatever it is, it's a $200 fee to you. That's an expense.
Exactly. Yes. Right. That's an expense that we have to pay to the property management company.
Right. Whereas, you know, if you said lease renewal fee, I would have thought, well, that's an income item, but it's not. I see the way you're putting that. Okay. Understood there. Understood. That's really helpful just to give some people some interesting things to look at on the underwriting side of things. Is there an expense ratio that is a typical red flag where you say, oh, dig in deeper, that number's too low?
Yeah. I mean, I would say anything under 50%, I'm going to take a very close look at, which is most things, right? Most performers are kind of under 50%. But I mean, if it's like 35%, that's a huge red flag and needs to be very, very closely looked at and probably bumped up, you know, for me to get comfortable with the deal. At least in my projections, I'm going to need to bump it up. And yeah, so I mean, I would say the rule of thumb of 50%, I think, is actually a good starting point. And anything less than that, I think, deserves scrutiny.
That's great. Talk to us about your investment kind of style. Are you going out as a direct sponsor? Are you doing fund of funds? Talk to us about that side of your business.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm an investor before anything else. And so I was looking for ways to diversify my own assets outside of hospitality. I didn't want to just have all of my assets invested in hospitality. And so I was looking for ways to place capital, for example, like the profits that come off of my hospitality business. I want to put them into recession resistant asset classes, not necessarily just more Airbnb units. Although, I mean, there is a case for that. But in any case, so I'm an investor first. And so I was looking for deals that I could put my money into. And then I realized that I'm needing to actually do a lot of work to feel comfortable investing. And so that's when I decided, okay, well, this is also something that's, I was meeting all these great sponsors. I was meeting all these great people who were doing deals and they had a need for capital. And I'm like, okay, well, I did all this work to make sure that I'm comfortable investing in you. And by a lot of work, I mean, relationship building, calls, these relationships get built sometimes over multiple years, take a while for me to really get comfortable with the person and their firm and how they're underwriting. And so it takes a lot of time. So I decided to say, okay, I'm doing all this work vetting these deals. I will start by creating recession resilient funds. And so, I mean, basically we're doing deal by deal for the most part, but I look at self-storage, I look at multifamily, senior housing, ATM funds, mobile home parks, and industrial. And so those are the asset classes that I'm currently focused on and currently looking at closely in order to present a diversity of offerings to my investors across asset classes, geographies, and sponsors. So like if I want to create a diversified portfolio of my own investments for myself, and then I'm able to offer that to other people. Whereas if I was a sponsor, I would more be just saying, hey, would you like to invest in my deal? And I wouldn't necessarily be able to offer that diversity.
That's brilliant. I love that. Yeah. And those are relationships that take oftentimes, like you said, years to develop, to get that. I mean, the three pillars are of a good sponsor is that you know them, you like them, and you trust them. And a lot of people don't have the time, quite honestly, to sit down and get to know all of those sponsors or want to get to know all of those sponsors. So I think that's a really brilliant model. Once you select those sponsors, are you coming in as a co-GP? Are you doing fund of funds? Is every deal different? What's that look like?
Yeah. So far I have almost entirely been doing fund of funds. So we create a special purpose vehicle, which investors fund into. And then we as LLC fund into the deal. And so we're not part of the GP for the most part. I mean, that could change at some point, depending on the sponsors and the relationship. But I decided to focus on the SPV model because it seemed the cleanest to me from a legal perspective. And I just didn't want to be operating in a gray area. Although, you know, that can be difficult because sometimes that's just all there is to operate in. But I wanted to be as clear about it as possible. And so that was part of what took me a long time to figure out was how do I do this in a way that I feel like is well protected from a legal standpoint. And the SPV has administrative costs, it has legal costs. And so it does cost some money. And so you have to make sure that depending on the size of the deal and how there's all these things you can do over time, you can negotiate with sponsors. So basically what we're doing is we negotiate for a higher split or something like that, so that we're able to take both our compensation and pay for the cost of the fund so that investors are usually getting the same deal or approximately the same deal that they would get if they went directly to the sponsor. And so that's also the benefit of investing as a group, is that you can command a higher equity split or something like that. And part of that is getting sponsors on board with the idea of offering different class shares. So saying, hey, okay, well, will you offer someone who invests $500,000 a different set of returns, et cetera, a different preferred return, a different equity split than you would just a normal $50,000 or $100,000 investor? Or maybe the hurdle is $1 million. Sometimes it's $2 million. So when we write a bigger check, we can command higher returns. And that's one of the ways we pay ourselves and pay, and our investors still get the same deal.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. And I think one of the things to point out there is that going back to the time it takes to develop those relationships with those sponsors, you know, those are pre-negotiated arrangements. Like, you don't just do that out of the gate. Once docs are drawn, once stuff is inked, once investors are putting money in, I mean, it's too late really to go back and say, oh, wait, we want a special class because we're going to bring $5 million to the deal and we want a special share class. Like, that ship has sailed at that point. So I think that's really interesting. You've given us a lot of things to think about today. I mean, we've talked about SPVs. We've talked about some really unique things on the underwriting side to look at. We've talked about asset diversification. We've talked about really what your feelings are, I think, on Airbnb and how it maybe isn't a recession-resistant asset class and why you're looking at other things and why you even formed a private equity firm. I think all of these have been a really just a unique story on how you have gone through your real estate journey. I mean, I guess there's one last and final question. Are you real estate full-time now, or is there still a W-2?
I'm full-time real estate. I've been full-time real estate since 2018. And so since 2018, I am no longer going to be working for any sort of W-2 job. And so that was something that I did actually start that in 2013. And then, you know, we didn't touch on this, but I went on this trip around the world, et cetera. And then I did end up going back to work for a short period of time because I wanted to grow my real estate portfolio faster. And it is easier to do that when you have a W-2. And so I did go back to work for a time. But yeah, I've cut the cord since 2018. And I love so much what I do. I really am passionate about closing the investing gap and helping people learn about how to do this type of investing. Any type of new investment takes time and energy to learn about. And, you know, you got to get comfortable with it. And all that takes a lot. And so getting people to that point where they feel comfortable investing and where they feel like their money is in good hands and that it's the smart thing to do with this portion of their portfolio is, you know, that's a big task. And I'm passionate about that. I like helping people get across that hurdle. Of course, it's also nice to invest with accredited investors who are just used to these types of deals. So I like to do both.
That's fantastic. Suja, we've learned so much today. One last question for you here before we totally wrap up. Can you define success for us, for you personally? What does success mean and how will you know when you have been successful?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, that is a very deep question. And it's something that I would say that I ruminate on at least weekly, if not daily. And so for me, success is, on one hand, it's all about just feeling good on a day-to-day basis, feeling happy, feeling fulfilled, feeling positive about the future, feeling like I'm making an impact on other people's lives. And then there's ways to achieve that, right? So there's areas of focus that I have, like my relationships, my physical health, my finances. My business is kind of separate than my finances because, like, what I'm able to accomplish in my business is not just a financial thing. It's also, well, how many people am I working with and who have I helped and what have I made possible for other people? And I mean, that's a huge part of like my business success as well. So I'm sure haven't touched on like all the important like areas of life, but success is something that you have to look at holistically and say, is this what I want my life to look like day to day? Am I fulfilled? Are my days how I want them to be? And it's like a constant reflection process where I'm constantly trying to tweak it and figure out like, okay, well, do I want to shift here now that I'm, you know, now that I've reached this goal, do I want to shift here? But yeah, those are sort of the principles that I think about is fulfillment. Yes, achievement. Achievement is important, but fulfillment is more important. Balancing those two, right? Because sometimes achievement can come at the cost of fulfillment because you can always achieve more, but then you also just need to give time to your relationships, to your hobbies, to your creative endeavors, to your spirit, etc. So it's a bit of a moving target, I would say, but something that's kind of how I think about it.
That's fantastic. I love that. I love that. Suja, thanks so much for coming on today. I've certainly enjoyed this. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
I have a podcast called Passive Income Unlocked. That's also a daily podcast, and I'd love for listeners to tune into that. Again, it's called Passive Income Unlocked. And you can just call me anytime you want or send me a text message. My phone number is 650-804-8043. Would love to talk to anybody about what they're thinking about regards to real estate or investing or anything else related to those general topics. So please feel free to reach out. Be happy to talk to anyone.
Suja, thanks so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. You too, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.